this one. Stay tuned for Bob Enyart Live, but first, here's our Denver Bible Church update. Hi, this is Pastor Bob Enyart of Denver Bible Church. And, of course, what do we do at our church? We study the Bible. And when you go through the Bible, there are things in it that might perplex you. And the more you study it, the more you get an overview, the better you can understand it. For example, the Bible talks quite a bit about casting lots. I'll just give you an example. Casting lots. Lots, it's like drawing straws or rolling dice. And a lot of Christians get a little uneasy about what is the Bible talking about, casting lots. If you're making a decision, you're trying to divvy up some resources, give out some work to different people. Well, who's going to get what? Who's going to do what? Well, cast lots, the Bible says. And in this particular verse, Proverbs chapter 16, verse 33, we read this, the lot is cast, and its every decision is from the Lord. The lot is cast, in other words, like rolling the dice, saying, okay, who's going to do what? Who's going to cut the front lawn, and who's going to cut the lawn in the backyard? Well, let's roll the dice, and we'll figure out who's going to do it. Well, the lot is cast, and every decision is from the Lord. Why is that? What does that mean? And you know, in the Old Testament, when God told the Jews that they would take the land in Israel, and the land shall be divided by lot among the tribes, in Numbers chapter 26, they shall inherit according to the names of the tribes of their fathers, and the land shall be divided by lot. According to the lot, their inheritance shall be divided. So that you've got these 12 tribes. Well, the Levites, they didn't get any land. They were the priests. They got land in a different way. But they took like dice or drawing straws. They cast lots and they figured out which tribes would get which land. The priest, they divided the priest, the descendants of Aaron, into 24 courses or 24 divisions. And they cast lots to see which group would go in order to serve the Lord in the temple. And they cast lots. Remember Zechariah in the New Testament. They cast lots to see who would go into the temple to burn incense. And the lot fell on Zechariah. And it goes on and on. To choose the first king, Saul, God had Samuel cast lots. And even though it's not as obvious in the text, they did the same thing to choose David from his brothers. And remember then the apostles, when Judas committed suicide on his way to hell, the apostles in Acts chapter 1, verse 26, it says, and they cast their lots, and the lot fell on Matthias, and he was numbered with the 11 apostles. So what's all this casting of lots in the Bible? Well, there's an important verse to understand it in Proverbs 18, verse 18. Casting lots causes contentions to cease and keeps the mighty apart. So many things in life, they have to do with things like, okay, let's say someone dies and you have to divide up the estate. And there are four sons and daughters, and they're going to fight over who gets what. And instead of allowing that fight and that family politics, which can be so ugly, divide it up into four lots, and then throw dice, draw straws, and see who gets what if you can't agree on it. Casting lots causes contentions to cease and keeps the mighty apart. Now, when Israel had functioning high priest and prophets, God would intervene supernaturally and also reveal his will or information via casting lots. But generally in the Bible, the casting of lots was just a practical thing to do to avoid difficulties. Now stay tuned for Bob Enyart Live. Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, America's most popular, self-proclaimed right-wing religious fanatic, homophobic, anti-choice talk show host. Our phone number is 1-800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. Boy, I guess I got away with that. Last night, I'm on a Christian talk show here, and last night I said that the arsonist in California who started one of the fires, if caught and convicted, should be executed. And no one challenged that. And I'm glad no one challenged it, because that's what should happen. He should be executed. So let's see, what else do we have here in the news? Oh, sadly, this is sad news, and we'll get right to the phones in a moment, 1-800-836-9278. Sadly, the TV host of The Price is Right has died yesterday. The Price is Right host died, and Satan was heard saying, "Johnny Olson, come on down." Oh, no, sorry. That's not right. Johnny Olson was the former host. This guy's name was Rod Roddy. I don't watch The Price is Right. But you know how he says, "Jane Smith, come on down." So the guy, the host of The Price is Right, died yesterday. And it's, yeah, our lives on this earth, we're one heartbeat away from the next step, from the afterlife. What happens forever. So was he young, that guy? Was he young? I don't know how old he was. But obviously, a lot of people die every day in the world. Some suddenly, startlingly, shockingly, and others after long illness. Not everyone has the luxury of a deathbed. And it's important to be right with God. Okay, let's go to the phones. 1-800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278 in Aurora, Colorado. Nathaniel, speak your mind.
Hello, Bob. How you doing, my friend? God bless you.
Doing well, sir. Thank you.
Bob, we're coming up on the Christmas season. You and your church, do y'all believe in Christmas? Do you celebrate it? Do you think it's a pagan holiday, which it is?
All right. Or,
and how do you feel about that?
All right. As far as the roots of various Christian holidays and the days that they're celebrated on, there are pretty strong arguments to be made that some days for various events were chosen to coincide with pagan holidays, so that back when Christians were being killed or persecuted, they wouldn't attract much attention, and they just started celebrating feast on certain days. Like for Christmas, December 25th, do we know that Jesus was born on that day? No, we don't. We don't. In fact, the evidence, I think, is more persuasive that he was born in the fall.
October.
Well, I think he was born, and we can't prove it, but I think he was born on the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles. And as the Apostle John said in a very unusual statement, he said, "Christ tabernacled amongst us." Mm. And tabernacle is a tent. And Jesus Christ, God the Son, took on a tent of the human body, and he tented among us. He that was the tabernacle on earth, Christ's own body, and he was God. So anyway, if he was born on the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, and then he was circumcised on the eighth day, the great and high day of the feast, and then he also fulfilled other feast days like Passover and Unleavened Bread and First Fruits and Pentecost. So all those feasts then would have been fulfilled in Christ's first coming. But at any rate, so if Jesus was not born on December 25th, and you can see that pagans celebrated in that day thousands of years ago, does that mean it's wrong for us today to remember Christ's birth on some day in the year, and in particular on that day? And Nathaniel, I can't see any fundamental principle that would be violated, any immorality or any sin, by remembering Christ's day on some day of the year. And December 25th seems as good as any other.
So you and your church, y'all do celebrate Christmas?
Yes.
Okay.
That was a long-winded answer, huh?
But that's all right, though. It was nice. It was nice. I don't know if I agree with it, but what I do is I call it Christmas,
yeah,
which means they at least talk about Jesus Christ all around the world, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about Christ in the Mass. I'm a inventor, and I think you would agree that most people like snow for Christmas.
Yeah.
When for Christmas.
Right.
Now, my invention is this. You put it above your window,
yeah,
inside or outside your house.
Yeah, and it snows?
It snows.
That is so funny, Nathaniel.
How you know that?
Well, I mean, it's cool.
I was on TV, and if you and your ministry need some cash,
yeah,
I would like to team up with you all, and we could try to push it. I already have a web page.
We could try to market it.
Yeah.
Snow for Christmas. Snow out your front window.
Anywhere in the world, no matter how hot the weather, it's not real snow, but it looks real.
It looks real.
So for the first time in history, the whole world can have a white Christmas.
How is the snow made? Is it made?
What I did is, when you get this styrofoam?
Yeah.
It's shaved styrofoam.
Oh.
So it's real small, and it's fluffy, and it floats down like real snow. So it can be 85 degrees outside.
And
outside your window, you get your own winter wonderland.
And how long does one tank load of styrofoam?
So if you fill it up, I'll say about an hour and a half or 2 hours.
Hour and a half or 2 hours of snow.
Yeah, depending on how fast you want it to come down.
Okay, and then does it is it a mess to clean up or what?
Well, we're going to have it for right now. Now, you know, when someone makes inventions, almost all of your inventions, you start off kind of rough sketch, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
And you always
Then they get refined.
Huh?
Then they get refined over time.
There you go. If you look at some of these old films, when these people were learning how to fly, those things were so funny. But they were spending big money trying to trap on those contraptions. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it wasn't working. But you're going to put it, it's going to come down in a big tub. And when it fills up, you just turn it back and put it back. It takes about 2 or 3 minutes to put it back and start it over again.
Well, if Sharper Image picks this up, or that Homlicker, Schlomaker, whatever that catalog is, then I think you'll be rolling in the bucks.
Now, who's that?
Sharper Image?
Yeah.
Oh, they sell the only the best products in mall outlets and by catalog around the country.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. That's.
But if you want to check it out, can I give you the website?
Well, yeah, go right ahead. I'm sure that our church, we're not looking for business opportunities.
Okay.
But give me the website and people will check it out.
Snowwindow.com.
Snowwindow, what a great.
.com.
Snowwindow.com.
And I'm believing God for the first time in history, 2003, the whole world is going to have a white Christmas.
All right. Hey, Nathaniel, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye. God bless you, my friend.
God bless you. Snowwindow.com. If a good name would make a business work, then Nathaniel's business will work. But sometimes you need more than that. We'll be right back.
At Bob Inyart Live and KGov.com, you'll find literature, audio, and video products that are a must for the library of any Christian interested in studying the truth of the Bible. You'll find essential material like the plot manuscript, an overview of the whole Bible that will clear up doctrinal issues. Then there's The Tree, a fun audio journey back to the Garden of Eden, where you'll learn about this most famous tree and its impact on humanity. Check out the Mount Moriah video. This video gives evidence for the resurrection, combining biblical and secular resources. It's a great witnessing tool. And don't forget the death penalty video. Learn that Jesus advocated the death penalty, and learn how God put the death penalty at the heart of the gospel. You can directly help Bob's outreach by subscribing to Best of Bob, Bob's Best 8 Shows of the Month, or build a Bible study library by ordering the monthly Bible albums. There's a lot more, so give us a call at 1-800-8-INYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. 1-800-836-9278 or KGOV.com.
This is Bob Inyart with a live commercial break. Do you have anybody in your family that's interested in science? Are you interested in science, volcanoes, geology, how the Earth's surface was formed, the strata that's in the Earth, the river systems, the canyons? Well, we have a video that we've been promoting this video for 4 years now, 5 years, and it's produced by the Institute for Creation Research. It's called Mount St. Helens. This is such a great video because Geologists took a lot of what we read in the Bible, and they said if you go around the world, you could see that there was a global flood that formed the features of the surface of the earth. But then Darwinism and secularism and atheism took such a strong foothold in science and geology. And so that was all changed. And they said, no, it takes billions of years to form, and millions of years to form canyons and river systems and on. So Mount St. Helens, we have photographic evidence of Mount St. Helens and the canyons it formed, in the strata it laid down, in the rivers. It's a great video. $24.95. Call us 1-888-8NYARD. Bob Enyard here, 1-800-8NYARD, 1-800-836-9278. The latest poll of the Democrats who are going for the nomination of their party for president, they threw Hillary Clinton in the mix to see, because, you know, Howard Dean is leading the pack. Well, with Hillary in, Hillary gets 43% of the vote, and Clark gets 10%, Lieberman 8, Gebhardt 8, Kerry 8, 7, and Howard Dean gets only 7%. Isn't that funny? He goes from leading the pack to only 7% if you throw Hillary into the mix. And what that shows is that while he's leading the pack, his support is very shallow. And these guys like Lieberman, Gebhardt, Kerry, and even Clark, their support is more substantive. Not that any of that matters, but let's go to the phones. In Denver, Colorado, Rita, speak your mind.
I was talking to a friend today, and she indicated that she thought it would be important for somebody to talk about the bond that's on the ballot this time around for Denver Public Schools as well as the mill levy.
All right. And why don't you go ahead and give us your opinion on that?
Well, people have asked me whether I support one or the other, and I've indicated that I am not in support of the mill levy. Which would raise an average home taxes by $48 mm-hmm. every year. Now, mill levy dollars are, and when you raise your taxes for a mill levy, those taxes go into perpetuity. They never end. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you vote for a bond for...
It's temporary.
Pardon me?
It's temporary.
It's temporary. It lasts for approximately 4 years, and then it ends, and your taxes either go down or they ask you to continue the taxes, but they have to come back to you. My problem with the mill levy at this point is that in 1998, the Board of Education passed a mill levy and a bond, and in that mill levy, they asked for some of the same things that are being asked for now. For instance, they told the public that they would get summer school for every child who wanted to go to summer school. There was money in the mill levy for maintenance of buildings. There was money for more technology. There was money for textbooks and a number of other items.
And Rita, let me guess, your opinion is that the money didn't really go for the things that we were told it would go for.
Well, for a little while it did, but to this date, we are now, 2003, they've eliminated summer school. Yet those tax dollars never end. The money mm-hmm. that they asked for those things will go into perpetuity, so they should be giving us summer school into perpetuity. Yet there is no more summer school. It doesn't exist. Textbooks, there are yet many schools that don't have textbooks so that middle and high school kids can take a textbook home to get homework. So some parts of town get homework, and they continue their educational process when they leave the doors of their schools. Other parts of town just go home because they don't have textbooks. They don't get homework, and so... there are yet kids who don't have textbooks, yet they've had 4 years of millions of dollars and an ability to buy the textbooks that they said they didn't have back in 1998. This year, they cut out of their general fund monies because they were in debt to the tune of $30 million to start off the school year. So they cut, and one of the things that they cut was school maintenance. They cut school maintenance to the tune of $5 million. They cut technology by $1 million. And in this new mill levy request, they're asking for money to buy textbooks. They're asking for money for maintenance of buildings, and yet they had money, and they still have money coming into them for maintenance of buildings, of which was given to them in the 1998 bond.
Well, when I've learned something working for the government through contractors for the military and working for corporate America like the phone company and Microsoft, I've learned that when people are spending other people's money, they don't spend it well.
That's right.
And the more money you give a government bureaucracy like education, it doesn't matter how much you give. If you increase their budget 10% a year, they're always going to want more money. Mm-hmm. And over the years, we've done this show for 12 years now here in Denver, Bob Inyart Live. In fact, we started on KLTT, the same station, back in 91. And from time to time, the local media, the newspapers, the Rocky Mountain News, the Denver Post, will give a listing of academic performance by state. And we'll also get occasionally a listing of academic performance of in countries around the world in science and different science and literature and
math.
And it's so interesting to see that over the years, one thing that remains consistent is that the countries and the states that spend less per pupil typically do better academically than the ones that spend the most. I don't know if you've ever noticed that, but we've correlated those numbers on this show from time to time.
Well, I agree with you. I think that the strange thing is that this school district, Denver, last year invested well over $17 million to buy a new reading program that would go district-wide. And yet there were schools that had bought their own reading programs. Of course, they weren't the one program that was picked by the superintendent, this new superintendent. And so they may have had their reading programs in place for two, maybe 3 years. And when the superintendent decided all of a sudden that he wanted just one reading program, he told people to throw out everything that they had, that they were bringing a new reading program that cost over $17 million.
Yeah.
And people say, well, $17 million for a reading program, well, who knows, perhaps it's too much. Well, what wasn't factored in is the cost of throwing out
programs. And that's when you're spending other people's money.
Exactly.
Rita, do you know if that program was it's a reading program, was it phonics-based?
It's not. As a matter of fact, it's whole language, and it's brought in by a group that's called the Institute for Learning, and they come out of Pittsburgh, and people in Pittsburgh say, we don't have that program here. No one school district has instituted it district-wide, and Denver's the only school district, and we can't understand why Denver's doing it because we don't see it of any value out here, and that's why you don't see it implemented in any one district in total.
That Institute for Learning, do you know the name of the founder of that?
I don't, but one of the founders is a woman by the name of Sally Mentor Hay, and she was hired by Denver School District to come out and implement the program to the tune of, I think she's being paid like $120,000.
Well,
her company is being paid a whole lot more than that.
Yeah, on this show this week, a previous show, we talked about phonics and whole language in our public schools around the country. And phonics, the reason kids that are going to private schools and homeschooling are doing so much better on standardized tests for reading is because most of those curriculums are based on phonics, which teaches kids the rules of how to read, how to sound out words, how to spell words. And for some reason, there's this jihad in our public school system against phonics, of all things.
Well, you know that California wiped out a whole language. Oh, I don't know if it's been 2 or 3 years now, but they had such a horrible experience with whole language that they wiped it out completely and instituted phonics. And so I think that, you know, there's the proof when you have the entire school district of Los Angeles.
Right.
And I believe it was statewide, but I know that Los Angeles wiped out whole language and put in phonics. That it has to say something to people that how bad and how revolting people find that whole language has been and how destructive it's been to our kids.
So, Rita, as a general principle here at Bob Inyart Live, we say vote no on any tax increase, especially for our public school system because it's a black hole when it comes to revenues. And the more revenue we pour into the public school system, we don't see improvements. And there, I don't believe there will be improvements when you've got homeschool kids on a national survey that are testing on standardized tests at 80 percentile compared to public school students at 50 percentile. And the homeschool parents, they're not professional educators. They're moms and dads, and they're doing a superior job as compared to our public schools.
Well, I won't go that far out to say that public schools, they're all of them are terrible. I think that there are some individual schools that are doing a great job and a really good job. For instance, there's a school in Southwest Denver, which is a Denver public school. It's a magnet school. It's called Trailer Fundamental. And it's a fundamental school. It doesn't do anything that requires any fancy new programs. It just teaches reading, writing, and arithmetic or math. And they are the second highest scoring school in Denver when it comes to the CSAP scores. And yet they're not doing anything incredulous in terms of newfangled ideas
right.
or programs.
Well,
so there are some public
schools that do
a good job.
Well, let me ask you this. Is their curriculum based on God, or is it godless, atheistic curriculum?
Well, you know that in public education, you cannot bring religion in. You can't roll it in. So
yeah, so an atheistic education. I mean, even in Russia, in their government schools, they teach religion. Even in Australia, even in Spain. But here, we have a thoroughgoing atheistic curriculum. So even if the kids come out of the schools better at math and better at reading, we fundamentally undermine the moral fabric of our country. And so those kids who know how to multiply, they also are getting divorces in epidemic numbers. So I cannot get excited about the public school system, which school is doing better in reading, because in morality and fundamental ethics, they're getting an F.
Well, I think that some people might, you know, find that difficult. There are, you know, thousands of people who have their kids in public education, many who are stuck there, others who do like, you know, one school or another, and still others that that are on the verge of trying to find another alternative.
Do you remember when Columbine happened, Brian Rohrbaugh, one of the dads mm-hmm. whose son was killed,
yes.
he was on a CNN program, like a town hall meeting with all Jefferson County officials, school sheriff's officials, and he pointed out to the superintendent of Jefferson County Schools that at Columbine they had these assignments, and they were told there are no right or wrong answers, and they asked the kids about serious things like killing people or stealing or sex outside of marriage or sex with someone else's spouse. And they give the introduction that there are no right or wrong answers, and then they ask them about murder. And his point was, when the school system has no moral foundation and they teach this totally amoral worldview, then we could expect that our kids will act like animals.
Well, I think that the other factor that you have to weigh in mm-hmm. with regard to what happened at Columbine is that if you look at the two boys who committed the crime and did kill many students there, you'll find that they were often alone, that you know, their parents both worked, gave them very little time. Their parents didn't know that they had bomb-making devices in their room.
Well,
their parents didn't know that they were carrying and toting guns and practicing practically
right.
in their backyard. So,
Rita, we're going to go to a local break here in Denver. But, of course, millions of kids have parents who are busy, but that doesn't deal with the school teaching them there's no such thing as right or wrong. Bob Inyard here with a live commercial break, chatting to those of you who are listening via the web right now at kgov.com. In 30 seconds, we'll be joined by our Denver affiliate audience. Hey, for those of you listening on the web, I want to encourage you to check out theologyonline.com, one of the most popular websites on the entire internet for talking about theological issues, morality, ethics, and it's fun. Have you checked it out lately? Theologyonline.com, hundreds of thousands of posts per year. You could get in the mix, so check it out. Bob Inyard here with a live commercial break. I'd like to tell you about more of our videos. We've got some fun, entertaining material for you to look at. Live from Las Vegas on the convention center floor, I got to debate about a dozen conventioneers and on all the popular issues that conservatives and liberals debate these days. And there was a $100 bill taped to the microphone. And if the conventioneer wanted to, if he could win the 3-minute debate, then he would get $100. So we had a lot of people step up to the mic, and it's a fun way to talk through the issues of the day, whatever it is, whether it's the death penalty or welfare or feminism or evolution or let's say the war on terrorism. Whatever it is, there are fundamental principles of right and wrong that are behind virtually every major controversy. And so that's one video you could test your views and see how would you answer these debates. It's called Live from Las Vegas. It's a lot of fun. It's a 2-hour video, $24.95. You can call us at 1-888-8-NYART, 1-888-836-9278. We'd like to finish up with Rita in Denver about the Denver initiatives, the mill levy and the bond for the Denver Public Schools. And then we'll go to Littleton, Colorado, and then a call from Indiana. But first, back to Rita. Have you heard this before, that many of our public schools will issue assignments and they'll say there are no right or wrong answers? And then they'll ask fundamental moral questions.
Having to do with morality or religion. But I do know that, you know, they have given quizzes to kids with no right or wrong answers.
Right. I read an entire list of 100 questions on the air years ago from Smoky Hill High School. Mm-hmm. And the instructions said there are no right or wrong answers. And then they asked kids, this was in an English class. No, I'm sorry, it was a history teacher, American history. They asked kids questions like, if a stranger on an airplane offered you $1,000 to have sex, would you consent? There are no right or wrong answers. Hmm. And it talked about killing people. And that's non-directive psychoanalysis, telling kids there's no such thing as right or wrong. The public high school in Parker High School, the school newspaper published the results of a survey they did of their own students, and they asked the kids, would you kill someone if you could get away with it? And 1/3 of the girls responded yes, and they printed that in the paper, and just over half of the boys said yes. And I think the reason that's happening is because the public schools are atheistic by definition. And if you have a godless curriculum, it cannot be a moral foundation. So no matter how good the kids get at math and science, it's a fundamentally amoral education we're giving our kids. And I don't want to pay for that. But Rita, thank you very much for informing us about this.
I would suggest to your listeners that they take into consideration the mill levy in Denver and that they vote it down.
Vote no. Thank you. We agree.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Rita. Bye. Appreciate that. Now let's go to Littleton, Colorado. Michael, speak your mind. Hello, Michael.
Yeah. Hi. How are you?
Doing well, sir.
Good. I wanted to respond to your comment about Christmas and the observance of it on the 25th of December.
Yeah.
And we know that we, you know, can't really pinpoint the day of Christ's birth and ascertain that in the New Testament. And on December 21st, however, that's really, on the Julian calendar, it's coincides with the winter solstice, because this day the sun begins to return in the skies, and pagan devotees of Mithra celebrated the Dies Natalis Solis, which is the birthday of the invincible sun.
So the winter solstice is the day when it's
December 25th, in the Julian calendar.
It's dark for longer on that day than any other day of the year.
Exactly.
It's the darkest day of the year.
Exactly. But the birth of Christ was assigned the date of the winter solstice, December 21st, because on this day, the sun begins its return to the northern skies. And pagan devotees of Mithra celebrated the birthday of the invincible sun because it was beginning to come back.
All right.
And so make a new cycle.
So you're giving us a few details here.
Yes, absolutely.
About how December 25th came to be in the ballpark. Now, if we want to look at Christ's birth and try to figure out what time of the year it was from the New Testament, we don't
We look at Luke 2, 8, and 11, where it says the shepherds were in the fields at night at the time of Jesus' birth.
That's a bit of a hint. That might zero it down to one part of the year or another year.
But in the book, there's a book called The Daily Life in the Time of Jesus. And in that book, it states that the flocks passed the winter under cover.
All right.
And if the shepherds were in the fields, that kind of sheds a little light that it probably wasn't in the deep of winter.
Well, I think I'll tell you what I think is the strongest clue in the New Testament for when was Christ born. I think the strongest clue is Luke chapter 1, verse 5, because we learn that in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias of the division of Abijah was of the division of Abijah. And if you recall, back in 1 Chronicles 24, David took the priesthood, the sons of Aaron, and divided them up into 24 courses or 24 divisions. And the eighth division was Abijah. And then they would go throughout the year, that 24 groups would minister in the temple. And after there was the Babylonian captivity and the temple was destroyed, but then after Esther and Nehemiah and Ezra, the sons of Aaron came back and they reestablished those 24 divisions, even though they only had a few of them come back. And so they resumed that order of going to the temple. And so we know that Elizabeth became pregnant during the service of the eighth of the 24 divisions of the priesthood. And then we know that Zacharias' wife, Elizabeth, her cousin Mary became pregnant on what? It was Elizabeth's sixth month.
Her sixth month, which would put it closer to the fall.
Closer to who?
The fall.
Well, I just bring this up, Luke 1:5, because I think it's our strongest clue. But I don't believe that that strong clue can be resolved down to a week or a month, because I haven't seen the evidence to resolve it. So, for example, the divisions, the 24 divisions, we know when they would have begun on the first day of Nisan or Abib, in the spring, right before the Passover, and they would have gone through the year, but then they would have run through twice. And so was it the first or was it the second? And it's complicated. I don't think we know exactly, and I don't think we need to be we don't need to be adamant in that we have to celebrate Christ's birth on December 25th, or adamant that it's wrong.
Not that it's wrong, but it does coincide with, you know, the Julian calendar's, the you know, pagan rituals devoted to Mithra.
Well, how did it get?
And it says that,
let me ask you, Michael, how did it get from the 21st to the 25th?
Because the 25th is the closest thing that coincided with Christianity at the time, and they used that to help incorporate that into Christianity.
Yeah, and see,
kind of pick a date, but they picked a date that actually fell
that day is not evil. Every day, the Apostle Paul says, if you worship the Lord on one day,
every day
of the week or every day, as long as you're worshiping the Lord. So there's not one day of the year that's evil, and it's neat to remember Christ's birthday.
Absolutely. Right. But I just don't think we should remember his birthday on a day that was noted throughout history.
Yep.
To another pagan god. It's
but wait a minute.
A crowd of people
coming over
to someone's home to celebrate a birthday.
Michael, wait.
And then they bring over,
Michael,
bring over gifts for everyone else.
Hold on a second. One second.
They drink.
Michael.
They engage in loose conduct.
Michael, can you hear me or
not? And they do it on one of the guy's enemies.
All right, I put Michael on hold. Michael, I was trying to interrupt you. I'll bring you back. Michael, you made an initial statement that I wanted to respond to.
Go ahead.
You said, I don't think we should celebrate Christmas, and then you made two observations. On a day that everyone knows is a day that throughout history was celebrated some pagan god. Two points to that. First of all, not everybody knows that. You know that. The vast majority of Christians have no idea. So you're bringing up something that they don't know, and they don't remember that day because it was a pagan. Secondly, it's not that day was not significant throughout history. There may have been a geographic locale in a time in history when that day was significant, but it's not like that's the day of evil throughout the history of the world, throughout the human race. It's one day of 365, and if it's almost like we're looking for ways to find people in sin. People are in sin plenty. We don't have to say, didn't you know? You're remembering a day that was a pagan holiday. And they say, no, I didn't know. I'm just remembering Jesus Christ, that he was born. In other words, it's like it's making a mountain out of a molehill. It's a tempest in a teapot.
I agree with that. But, on one point, during the time of Christ, Rome was, the strongest country and capital and society in the world, everything grew out of that.
But no, but the Roman religion was, for the most part, not even taken seriously by Romans. And there were many competing religious views in the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Jews eventually and Christianity that overcame all those earlier religious ideas. And so, yeah. But let me ask you a question. It's a New Testament question. What if there was a temple? I think it's a related question. There's a temple and they're offering animals, killing animals to worship some false god. All right? They've got a false god and in the basement, in the first floor of the temple, they take the animals that they offered to their false god and they're serving them in a restaurant. So they slaughter the animal and offer its blood on the altar to some goddess Diana or somebody. And then they take the meat of the animal, and on the first floor they have a restaurant. And so you, as a Christian, can decide whether or not it's acceptable to go to that restaurant and buy the food and eat in the temple. And the New Testament addresses that. The Apostle Paul addresses that particular circumstance. And I think that he does that in the book of Corinthians when he wrote to the Corinthians, and I think in chapter 8. And I think that quite a few Christians might object and say, hey, wait a minute, that's not right. You can't.
Right. Well, he said, don't ask if you don't want to know. And
well, that's when you go
that
to the
way you're not offending the people, but also it's not what you put into the mouth that defiles you. It's what comes out of your mouth.
No, he didn't. Don't ask was when you go to a meat market. Right. This is if you're eating in an idol's temple in 1 Corinthians 8:10. So if you have knowledge that it's okay and you're eating in an idol's temple, then a weaker brother might stumble. But you have knowledge, and you can eat in an idol's temple, although you do love your weaker brethren, and you might not want him to stumble. But
right.
But so on the same, so someone could say, if that verse wasn't in there, 1 Corinthians 8:10, then some Christian could tell others it's a sin to eat in an idol's temple because you're supporting idolatry. And not only that, the Old Testament said, don't eat meat sacrificed to idols. And so the Apostle Paul said, it's okay, you could eat meat sacrificed to idols, but you don't want to cause the weaker brethren to stumble. And if you're eating, if you have knowledge, in other words, you know it's okay, and you're eating in an idol's temple, well, then a weaker brother might stumble. And so out of concern for him, you might not want to do it. But my point is, when the New Testament doesn't say, like the New Testament tells us, fornication is sin, stealing is sin. So we know those things are sins. But
right.
we can make up our own rules, and we can tell people remembering Christ's birthday on December 25th is a sin. But it's not.
No, it's not a sin.
Yeah,
it's just a point of view that it did happen to be incorporated into Christianity because it fell very close to a real popular pagan festival at the time. And on that day, they honored Mithra, who was a pagan god.
And
now,
Michael,
the majority of people honor Christ on this day unknowingly.
Michael, and how many Americans, out of 1,000 Americans, how many know who Mithra is?
Well, hopefully more.
well, how many right now out of 1,000? Did one out of 1,000?
I wouldn't have a guess.
Probably not. Maybe one out of 3,000 know who Mithra is. And so it's not like a pressing issue. It's of interest, historical, you know, it's a curiosity. That's how I view it.
Well, but also I wonder how Christ feels when we... You know,
we remember him
on a pagan god's festival day.
Well, if you eat in an idol's temple, he says through Paul, that's okay. Because the meat is clean. And if you remember him on what day?
Well, Paul also said, didn't he, that he would never eat meat again once he found that out so he wouldn't make a brother stumble.
That was hyperbole. He ate meat.
But once he gained the knowledge
he ate meat.
Was imparted to him,
he ate,
and he knew that that could make a brother stumble.
He didn't say he wouldn't. He said if it were necessary, he would give up meat, for example. But he didn't give up meat.
Right. If it was necessary, he would never eat meat again in order not to do that.
Because he didn't want the weaker brothers to stumble. So if you're saying, Michael, that some who are weak will be offended at December 25th, and that the stronger Christians who have knowledge should be concerned for the weaker Christians, then you could make that argument. But I don't think you would
want to. Right. Then you could put this knowledge out and impart the knowledge to them and let them make an informed decision on whether or not they would like to continue honoring Christ's birthday on December 25th.
Because I hold the position I do, I obviously think that Jesus Christ is perfectly happy with us remembering his birth on that day. He doesn't have the slightest. It's not like there's bad days and good days. There's bad hair days, but that's about it. Hey, thank you. Michael, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
God bless you. I appreciate the call. And it's interesting. Let's go to Indiana. Dwayne, speak your mind.
Yes, Mike, or Bob.
Yes, Dwayne.
Excuse me. Yeah, greetings and very nice to be on your show here.
Thank you. It's good to have calls from out of state, since we're on the internet around the world, of course, but on the air we're only on in Denver at KLTT AM 670.
Well, over here you have a loyal following, and I like you very much. I listen to your shows on the internet.
Cool.
And so I try to keep up with you as best I can, and I looked the newspaper, and this story jumped at me.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd get with you. I don't know if you, I think you probably covered the initial story. It's about the murder of Biggs. Was it Brandon? No. let's see here.
Well, just give us the general description of what happened.
Yeah. The windshield murder. in Fort Worth, Texas.
Oh, the woman who hit a man. He fell through her windshield, and she continued driving home and parked in her garage with him stuck and begging for help, and she let him die.
And I don't know if he was there for a couple days or something.
For into the next morning, maybe, something like that.
For a good period of time.
It was a vicious and wicked, negligent homicide murder. It was vicious.
I didn't know for sure if he could have, if it's possible that he could have survived with medical attention.
I think that was stated in the media, and I, of course, you know, didn't sit on the trial, and I don't know the details, but regardless, she injured him. She was drunk when she was driving, right?
I also heard that she may have been on the, I don't know if it was ecstasy, one of those new rave drugs.
Yeah, right. Same thing, basically, same effect.
Right.
She was not, so she was negligent by driving while impaired, and then she hit someone, and then he was crying out for her help, and she left him wedged in the front of her vehicle and left him to die. Now, what should be the punishment there, Duane?
She should be put to death.
Right, that's true, because in the Bible, if you're negligent, and because of your negligence, people die. So even if it wasn't intentional, if it's just deadly negligence, you're to be put to death. And God shows us that in the Bible, in Exodus and Deuteronomy, like Exodus 21, for example, and Deuteronomy 22, deadly negligence, if you're convicted, you get put to death. So she should be put to death.
And now, you know what story brought this to the newspapers? I don't know if that was quite a while back ago. I read this from the Wisconsin State Journal, Monday's edition, and the son, Brandon Briggs, it was, I believe, Gregory Briggs.
Was the man who was killed.
Right, the victim. This story was about forgiveness and death row inmates.
He's the kid who forgave the woman. Right?
Right.
And
he's
celebrated by ignorant Christians because he forgave his father's killer.
Well, I was reading the whole passage, the whole story, and I kept waiting for any sign for what she had said, and it's utterly admitted. It's a one-sided. It's only about Brandon Biggs.
In other words, did she repent? Did she say, "I'm sorry, please forgive me"?
Completely. Not even mentioned.
Because Christians have erred terribly when they've taught that you have to forgive everyone whether they repent or not. That's a false teaching. Jesus Christ said in Luke 17:3, he said, "If someone sins against you, forgive him." Is that what Jesus said? No. He said, "If someone sins against you, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him." If he repents. So this woman cannot be forgiven for the murder because the victim, the one she sinned against, is dead. And so the judge should have her executed. But, of course, our laws are corrupt, and that won't happen. But this kid, the son, he doesn't have the standing to forgive her for the murder. He doesn't have the standing. He wasn't murdered. You can forgive people who sin against you, but not those who sin against your neighbor or your father. So he can't forgive her for the murder, but he could forgive her for hurting him indirectly. But he should only do that if she repents. And if she repents, that would mean she would plead guilty and she would accept responsibility. And as I recall the story from a long time ago, those things were not happening.
The newspaper says that he had an overwhelming desire to forgive this woman.
Yeah.
And that he forgave her past tense, so he did just plain out
Said
that he had forgiven
her. This is going to sound weird, but it's a lust of the flesh. It's a holier than thou self-righteousness. Because when we forgive people that God doesn't forgive, are we more righteous than God? Are we holier than God? Are we more good than God? Are we nicer than God? God does not forgive unrepentant murderers who he sends to hell. So he sends them to hell, and here we are, better than God, and we forgave them. So the Christian teaching makes repentance unnecessary. And millions of unbelievers are going to hell because they think that God will forgive them, right, whether they repent or not, because God is a God of forgiveness, because all Christians are taught you have to forgive, period. That's it. You got to forgive in every circumstance, regardless of whether people repent. And that's not true. Jesus didn't forgive everyone. The Apostle Paul didn't. The prophets didn't. King David didn't. And God doesn't. And the saints who are in heaven right now, in the book of Revelation chapter 6, the ones who were martyred for the testimony of Jesus Christ, we read, when was it the sixth seal that was opened? And the saints who were under the altar cried out to God. And they said, God, forgive those who murdered us. No, they didn't. They said, oh, Lord, how long until you avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? The righteous Christians who were in heaven, they didn't have any of this self-righteous, holier-than-thou, nicer-than-God, phony religion. Yeah. And they saw God face to face.
And God would forgive, and he would love and forgive if you're sorry.
If you're sorry. And so this kid, even though I'm sure he's a neat Christian who loves God, it's obvious, right?
Uh-huh.
He must be.
He wants to go to seminary.
Yeah, well, what a shame, because he'll just give more bad teaching to more Christians.
Well, this is what he's hooking up with, Compassion, a newsletter. He got a $10,000 scholarship
from Compassion International?
Well, it's not. I don't believe it's that connection,
okay,
but it's
all right. All right, yeah. And so what's happening is this woman who's in jail now, if she ends up going to hell eventually, it will be partly his fault for miscommunicating to her the Christian message. Because his message to her is, you get forgiveness whether or not you repent. And that's false teaching that the Church of Jesus Christ is guilty of. We teach that everyone should be forgiven. It's not true.
Yeah.
I got to go, Duane.
Okay.
Thank you for your call so much. Now, Doug, we have 1 minute, Doug.
Hello.
Doug in Denver, Doug McBurney.
All right, Bob, my wife and I were watching Larry King the other night. Michael Schiavo was on.
Yeah.
The husband of the woman who is in a coma.
Right, he wants to starve her to death.
Right. So an interesting question came up.
Yeah.
All through the interview, I was wondering, why does this guy feel like he has to kill this woman?
Right.
What is it that drives him? And at one point I said, you know, I think probably biblically he could divorce her without the guilt of sin and get married to another woman.
He practically is married, right?
Well, yes, he is. Anyway, my wife was a little upset when I said that.
Oh.
She said, I don't think biblically he has the right to divorce her, and especially without, like, the guilt of sin.
I think, you know, abandonment is grounds for divorce in the Old and New Testament. But if you're injured or sick or have a disease, that doesn't qualify as abandonment.
Doesn't qualify.
No, so your obligation would be to take care of your wife for the rest of her natural life, for the rest of your natural life. If you're, let's say your husband is a drug dealer,
right,
and he's a criminal and he gets shot up, and so in a criminal, because of his criminal behavior, he's now effectively out of the marriage,
right?
I think you could divorce him.
Okay, what if he wants to have kids?
He has to have the kids with his wife,
and she's not capable.
Well, we don't know that, I guess. But
I guess we don't know.
Yeah, but that's not that doesn't justify divorcing an innocent wife who hasn't given grounds for divorce.
Well, the guy's a big time slime bag.
He is. Thank you, Doug, and we'll be back. This is Bob Inyart reminding you to do right, risk the consequences. And tomorrow night, Rush's brother, David Limbaugh.